For decades, the energy and environment portfolios have been run by different federal ministers, and they've often been at loggerheads over key elements of national policy. Look, in a surprise move, the Prime Minister's reshuffle yesterday sees the two ministries combined, eliciting mixed reactions. The former Resources Minister, Josh Frydenberg, has been given the new top job. The Climate Institute has long advocated an integration of energy and climate responsibilities under one ministerial roof and welcomed yesterday's announcement. John Connor is the CEO of the Climate Institute and he joins me in the Sydney studio. Good morning.
Morning.
Did you have any sense this was on the cards?
Look, it was a bit of a surprise, but not surprising, because we and indeed business and energy players have been calling for this and a desperate need to integrate climate and energy policies as we move forward, because we've had a hodgepodge of policies and we've seen investment stalled in this sector, and we need to shake that down.
So why do climate and energy go together?
Well, because energy is one of our biggest contributors of greenhouse pollution in this country, and electricity itself is a third of our emissions. And we've got the Energy Council, Business Council, Australian Industry Group realising that to meet, come even close to the kind of goals that this government agreed in Paris in terms of warming, we need to decarbonise the economy, economies like Australia, but we also need to have energy is a strategically significant part of that.
So it all comes to Josh Frydenberg, now responsible for a coherent climate and energy plan for the future. It's a big challenge, you say, as the government needs to put in place a pathway to decarbonise the Australian economy, basically within 30 years. Is Frydenberg the person to do that, do you think?
Well, this is a whole of government issue. I mean, so I think you can get caught up on particular personalities, but we've got Julie Bishop as leading our international negotiations. Greg Hunt now in industry, innovation and science. There's a heck of a lot of climate in all of that as well, and the opportunities that are there in clean energy and other clean technologies which have been pushed to the back burner. So I think it's important, though, that we do combine energy and climate, and in particular that we've actually got resources hived off from energy. I think that's been a bit of a bugbear in the past in Australian politics, where there is much more of a question of gamekeeper, poacher issues, where you've got the person responsible for overseeing the expansion of mining and gas and coal and other minerals, also having to say with the energy sector, which very much needs to clean up, to go clean. And indeed, on our reckoning, we need to have the coal-fired power stations replaced over the next two decades. And that's going to need not only an economic, but a community strategy, which needs to be very carefully done.
It's interesting, isn't it, the notion of resources and energy together. Of course, Josh Frydenberg was the resources minister, and while he held that portfolio, he spoke very enthusiastically about fossil fuels. He was on Insiders in October. Here he is talking about the massive Adani coal mine in Queensland.
It will create thousands of jobs. It will see more than $15 billion invested into those regional economies. But most importantly of all, it will help lift hundreds of millions of people out of energy poverty, not just in India, but right across the world. Well, I think there is a strong moral case here. More than 2 billion people today are using wood and dung for their cooking. Now, the World Health Organization says that this leads to 4.3 million premature deaths. So there is a strong moral case that the Green activists sometimes don't comprehend.
He's very clear there, a strong moral case for coal mining. Boop, now he's the Environment Minister. How do you view that?
Well, I think that was early on in his portfolio, but I think what is important that by combining the responsibilities of and accountabilities of the Environment portfolio, then I hope that it's a time to actually have a clear look at what they entail and what the responsibilities are of meeting the climate goals that the Turnbull government agreed to in Paris. And I think that will put more transparency and more focus on these issues for him as Minister, but for the government as a whole. And that Paris element is very important, because the government is coming up to a big review next year. The processes that Paris agreed, it was actually quite a phenomenal process of checks and balances and ongoing improvement in policy. And in 2018 itself is a big global stocktake. And so this government in one of the most carbon intensive economies in the developed world has a lot to do to catch up with what's going on around the world, to clean up its act and fulfil its responsibilities.
Okay, so what specifically, first of all, why does it matter that Frydenberg said that early on in his portfolio. Why did you say that?
Well, I think people, when they're learning their ropes and they're getting briefings from stakeholders and the like, and so I mean that line is certainly a line that the spruikers of the coal industry have used. It's actually much discredited in terms of some of those a lot of the poor in India are nowhere near electricity major transmission lines, and the IEA itself, the International Energy Agency itself, has acknowledged that, and so some of those lines can't come up, and so I think it's about sifting through the lines that come at you and then actually forging a way ahead. Now there's more experience there, I hope, and I think the accountabilities are important.
So you're saying he was a bit naive there?
Oh, I just think that some of those things are bubbling around when you actually you're absorbing the briefings early on.
Okay. And did you detect any changes in his tone while he was the resources minister?
Oh, look, he did, for one, rule out public funding for Adani for the any of the transport, and I think that's a big question moving forward. So it certainly, there wasn't a rush in that regard to be spending taxpayers' dollars on Adani itself, that coal mine.
Okay, so what will he need to do? As you say, next year is critical for climate policy in Australia. The government's climate targets and the policies to get there will need to be reviewed. He'll lead that review. What will that entail?
Well, whether that's led out of Prime Minister and Cabinet, I think that's one of the things to be seen, because it is a whole of government issue. Who actually leads that review? The terms of reference of that review are important. How much it actually links into the Paris climate goals and ongoing scientific review. Australia has committed to be considering a long-term review. We've got countries around the world setting full decarbonisation targets. The UK has done one. The US and Canada just agreed to be setting up this year 2050 strategies. And so I think this is where this government needs to join others and to recognise the science that we need to be at net zero emissions as an economy by well before 2050.
So you're saying that effort, whichever target they choose to hit or to aim for, may in fact be led out of the Prime Minister's office, or it may be led out of Frydenberg's office. You don't know which.
Oh, well, we'll need to see that. As I said, this is a whole of government. This involves foreign affairs. This involves industry. This involves innovation. This involves health. This involves as well as environment, energy. So all these elements are important. The recent review of for the 2030 target was led by the Prime Minister's office, for example, Prime Minister and Cabinet and the Prime Minister's office. So that may be the case moving forward.
Which would be preferable in your view?
Well, I think this is a whole of government thing. So I think, obviously a lead role will be played by Frydenberg and his office, but I think it should be a whole of government approach as well. And so the Prime Minister's office will need to be, and Prime Minister and Cabinet will need to be playing a key role in that review. It is important. I mean, we have got mainstream business, investors and others all saying now and that it is in Australia's interest that we do what we can to avoid more than 2 degrees warming. That's in our economic, social and as well as environmental interests. Those groups also all recognise that countries like Australia need to be at net zero emissions or below. So unlike anything in the last toxic decade of tumultuous politics in this space, we've actually got some common ground about where we need to be. We need to be a decarbonised economy, but we need to have careful strategies which do look at competitiveness challenges, but actually also look at the climate science, that we need to do this quickly. We need to do this in the Climate Institute's view. We need to actually have a plan to phase out of coal-fired power over the next couple of decades pretty steadily. We need to have stronger 2030 targets, but we've also got to have much greater clarity. And I think we can have common ground even with both the major political parties on the objective of net zero emissions by 2050 at least.
So let's assume that the Prime Minister will be keenly involved in all of this. How do you view the difference between the Prime Minister's publicly stated views on action to deal with climate change from 2009, when he was the opposition leader and lost that leadership over this issue, and his views as Prime Minister in 2016? How much daylight is there between those two?
Well, I think the key test will be through this review process in 2017. Obviously, some could argue he wore his heart on his sleeve much more in 2009 and been much more guarded. Certainly, it wasn't a major issue run by at the top of the agendas of either the major parties in the last election. And maybe in that, paradoxically, is a good thing, in that actually realised that both major parties realised there are are very significant changes here. This involves economic change. This involves a lot of communities in regional Australia who, by the way, see the opportunities and benefits in that. And we've seen, we track attitudes. Regional Australians and coalition voters have seen a big jump in concern about climate change in the big majorities. And they also see that tackling climate change can lead to jobs and investment in clean energy. And so I think that's the spirit with which we need to move forward.
Yesterday, we heard on this program from the Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Adam Giles. He was calling for a national energy summit, and he pointed to the fact that in South Australia, electricity prices have surged above $1,000 a megawatt hour this month. He blamed South Australia's reliance on wind power for all of that. High prices when the wind drops, he said, and he pointed to Labor and the Greens and said, look, that's what you get if you move to renewables in this way. And he said there needed to be a summit to look at all this. What's your view of that?
Oh, look, I think you need to be careful listening to some politicians' claims, particularly those who are in the heat of an election campaign and when they're behind, where they might want to point scapegoats. These changes can be challenging, but the reality is that the price spikes are driven much more by the gas price at the moment, because that's the actual marginal price setter in what is a complex national electricity market. The gas prices are spiking high. They've also got gas players obviously enjoying this moment, the moments when they can do that. But we've got challenges because we've expanded gas. We've now got international export of gas, and gas mining is challenging amongst communities as well.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
John Connor, CEO of the Climate Institute.